Well, it's what they're all talking about now. Oil prices dropping to $50 and bye-bye revenues. What do we do? The governor wants your ideas, and it's the subject today. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. What do we do to have a sustainable fiscal situation in Alaska? Our phone number, 1-800-478-8255, to join the conversation toll-free, 478-TALK. It's a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. Alaska Common Ground and ICER are about to conduct public forums and are warming them up for them today on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. If you're not covered by health insurance, you may be eligible for financial help with monthly premiums and out-of-pocket expenses. Open enrollment ends on February 15th. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Last year, 88% of Alaskans who enrolled received financial assistance. Compare plans and see if you qualify for financial assistance. Call 211 to get free local help. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, here we go. I imagine we will get a lot of calls on this because people never lack for ideas on state money, how to cut spending, what we should not cut spending on is always a popular one, and what kind of reserve should we dip into for what? Because there's no question about what we're going to have to dip into our reserves to sustain state spending this year, just as well as coming fiscal year, just as we are in the fiscal year that we're in. But the question is, you know, are there enough reserves to bridge the gap? And the gap from where to where when you don't know? Well, it just gets to be kind of a head scratcher. So what do we do? What do we do? Well, the University of Alaska Anchorage Institute for Social and Economic Research and Alaska Common Ground are combining forces, and they might really have kind of the perfect storm of public conditions to actually find some kind of public common ground, oddly. So I guess we'll start with you, Cliff Groh of Common Ground. There are a series, then, of public forums that are going on?
We're going to start out tomorrow, and thanks, Dee, for having this program on this biggest, most complicated, and most important problem facing Alaska. And the first, I mean, one of, and you've been kind enough and public spirit enough to hold a number of programs on this important issue over your decades of service here in public radio. We're starting out tomorrow in the new year, in 2015, holding a program at ICER, at the Institute of Social and Economic Research, tomorrow, Wednesday, from 12 to 1 p.m., on the question of the fiscal challenge, what the problems the state faces and the range of steps available to address it. And then Gunnar and I are also going to go to Gunnar Knapp, the director of ICER, sitting next to me here in the studio, are also going to go to Juneau later this month and make some presentations there as well. We're open to other presentations on this very important topic.
Yeah, well, and I might add that...
Go ahead, Gunnar Knapp.
Yeah, this is Gunnar Knapp, and I would add that we welcome opportunities to talk to any group that is, looking for basic information about the facts of the fiscal situation. That's our goal, basically, not to tell Alaskans what to do, but to help Alaskans understand the actual situation that we're in so that we can have an informed debate about this major pressing challenge that faces Alaska.
Well, Gunnar, you and Scott Goldsmith have been working on these numbers for a while now, and I'm kind of wondering about just some bottom line things, like how much reserves does the state have right now if they were to combine all the reserves, including the earnings reserve of the permanent fund? How much would there be?
Well, the basic way you can think about our reserves are, first of all, we've got at the beginning of this fiscal year about $12 billion in the more easily accessible cash reserves. That's the so-called Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund and the Statutory Budget Reserve. And those are certainly the reserves that the state will look to first in covering this year's deficit, just as we've covered the past 2 years' deficits, and probably for next year as well. Beyond that, there are other reserves that we could legally tap into, but they'll become politically more and more controversial as you tap into them. The largest source of cash on hand is the so-called Permanent Fund Earnings Reserve, which has this year about $5 billion in it. And, of course, that's the reserve that pays for dividends, and also that contributes to the earnings that we get from the permanent fund. So it undoubtedly become much more controversial to tap into that. Beyond that, there are other smaller funds that the legislature set aside to pay for other long-term uses, and it would undoubtedly also be very controversial to tap into those funds, but they are potentially available to the state.
So without the Permanent Fund Earnings Reserve, which you're thinking probably politically is just simply off the table for the next year or two anyway.
Well, I think anybody who knows Alaska politics would say that is not what people are going to look to first, certainly, yeah.
You know, I always wonder, you know, if there were some kind of log roll, because people don't even really know what it is. That, you know, it's so confusing to even try to explain what it is and what role it plays in the dividends and so forth like that. But this is money that just sits there. This is money that just sits there earning more money. It's not the corpus of the fund.
Well, I think that, again, Alaskans
people think that it's taking away people's dividends if that reserve is dipped into, but it wouldn't affect the dividends, only very slightly, because their dividends are based on the earnings of the fund.
Yeah, to review basically for our listeners, the permanent fund has about $50 billion, somewhat more than that, in it. And under the Constitution, we're not allowed to use the principal of the fund, but we are allowed to use the interest earnings of the fund. And what we've been using those interest earnings for is to pay for dividends and also to inflation-proof the fund. So some we've been putting into the principal over time. But these interest earnings every year go into the so-called earnings reserve, and it's that earnings reserve that pays each year for that year's dividends. But there's more money in there than is needed. There's more than enough money to cover the dividends in there. So it's a potential source of money that could be tapped. But I think Alaskans are going to psychologically, they're very much going to associate that with being part of the part of the fund, and they are part of what the fund earns interest on, and so. And the interest earnings affect the dividends under the formula and so on.
Right. Well, Cliff Groh, will these presentations, which you're happy to do more of, by the way, will they also talk about options, revenue options? Because that seems to be the direction the public conversation is going. Is, oh, well, maybe an income tax. Oh, well, maybe a fuel tax. Well, maybe this or that. Some kind of other things to raise. Diversify the revenue sources, it seems like, would be kind of a timely thing, policy thing to be bringing up now.
Yes, the presentations that Gunnar Knapper and I are going to do over the next few weeks also include discussions of various possible options for the state, which also include, in the large range of them, steps or options the state could use to raise revenues. There are a lot of them. That have been discussed over the years. They tend not to be very politically popular, but it's important to understand that, as you're sort of suggesting, you've talked about before over the air here, Alaskans are some of the lowest tax people in the United States, and Alaska has one of the probably the most structurally imbalanced fiscal system in the United States, because we've relied so much on oil money for decades. oil money, which is, of course, running down, both because of the long-run drop in production of oil from the North Slope of Alaska, as well as the recent crash in oil prices, which have fallen into the 40s in some of the future markets in the last 24 hours or so. And so Alaskans need to face the fact that the kind of Alaska fiscal system we've had for decades is going to change one way or another, and recent events have suggested it's going to change sooner rather than later. People have talked about a whole variety of things over the years that, in terms of a list of options, from income tax, as you've suggested, to a statewide sales tax, to some people have talked about, and one of the things that needs to be addressed is whether the oil tax system might get changed again. A variety of other options people have discussed, ranging from perhaps more aggressive or intense auditing of tax and royalty payments that oil companies make, to other ways of thinking about. I've even heard discussions of things like capital gains taxes. But Alaskans need to think about and consider carefully both the impending change that's going to be forced on the state and the state's fiscal system, and also the philosophical and practical considerations are going to come with the changes that are made, because there are going to be a lot of those kind of thoughts that need to be taken into account.
Well, you were the calls are already starting to come in, and I want to get to them, but I want to go a little bit deeper here in terms of the income tax idea, because as my understanding, and Jay Hammond would never tire of saying, and now Clem Tillion is saying, look, you give out this dividend, but the fact of the matter is that the IRS immediately gets about a third of it, because they are entitled to collect taxes on it. Better the state would collect the taxes, and then the IRS wouldn't have so much to tax. What's wrong with that? Nothing's wrong with that, right? You all agree.
There's some important distributional consequences that Alaskans need to think about. And different groups of Alaskans will be affected in different ways by, for example, a reduction in permanent fund dividends, potential reduction in permanent fund dividends, versus, for example, the levying of a progressive or graduated income tax or a statewide sales tax.
I think that as all of us who've been listening to really this discussion in various forms for decades are aware, we have a situation where we've been spending much more money than we're taking in, and it can't go on. And so we either have to reduce our spending or find new ways to get revenues. And the problem we face as a state is that none of these there is no easy option, and anything that you talk about, you can find powerful reasons why a lot of people don't like them. And you mentioned, people can present, for example, the logic of, well, if we hadn't, if we had an income tax, we could sort of get a particular benefit, as composed to letting the government collect taxes on the dividend. But there's also all kinds of very powerful reasons why the dividends are a good thing and why Alaskans like them. And so the challenge we face is not to find some elusive, perfect solution that everybody go, oh, yeah, that's it. That's what fixes everything and what we all like. But rather, how are we going to come up with a solution to our problem that politically we can all accept, and there isn't one that is going to be universally popular or even mildly popular.
Yeah, so it's more a question of trying to find that common ground, to speak.
And this is the.
I do think it's important to bring up the common ground is a totally nonpartisan.
Nonpartisan,
completely nonpartisan.
Nonprofit organization that tries to get Alaskans to come together, understand the major issues facing our state, and perhaps reach common ground or consensus in ways of dealing with them. This is, of course, as we said before, the most complicated and important problem facing the state, and there's going to be a lot of discussions that need to occur. And we hope they're both honest, intelligent, and far-reaching to help people actually come to grips with the choices the state faces and the implications of those choices.
Yeah, and I would also emphasize that at ICER, at the university also, we are not advocating any particular choice. We're not advocating any particular path. What we're trying to do is help inform people about the facts of the situation so that we can have an informed discussion.
It's not like you guys are the experts, so people can come up with their ideas and throw them at you, and you will have the expert opinion. All you have is information.
Experts cannot answer the question of what Alaska needs to do now. Experts can sort of help explain the facts and some of the trade-offs among different options, but Alaskans have to decide what choices they want to make among very, really unpleasant options.
The choices are not simply matters of accounting, but as we discussed before, matters of philosophy and values. And people need to think clearly about what values they hold and what values are most important in coming to the decisions that are going to be forced upon Alaska here shortly.
So I guess you would certainly be all in favor of people participating in the process the governor and lieutenant governor have underway right now in terms of trying to get public input and see what anything that can be done to reduce the state budget, to generate more revenues and anything like that. This is a good time. We got a new governor. He's got as much of a mandate as a governor gets. and people are, so he has a chance to really throw something down in front of the legislature here in the next few weeks.
If there was ever a time anybody was thinking of getting involved in the political discussion in Alaska, paying attention to what's going on, weighing in with the legislature, with the governor, now's the time to do it. Now's the time to tell your elected representatives what programs you care about in state and local government, which ones you think you'd be willing to see less of. Now's the time to tell them what you do or don't want or could accept in terms of new ways the state might collect revenues, because this discussion is going to be happening. The legislature and governor have to deal with this situation. They will be dealing with it, and we're all going to be affected, so now's the time to weigh in and let them know.
Okay, I've got plenty more things that I want to bring up, like S-21, for instance. But it's time to let the listeners at you. So let's start with Terry and Valdez. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Terry, with Gunnar and Cliff.
Yeah, royalties on minerals. The Pebble Mine debate was a real eye-opener for me, in that the state was going to get a 2% royalty off of that. And with monitoring of that, that would basically be a revenue-neutral deal. It just doesn't seem right for an international corporation to be able to come in and take billions of dollars worth of minerals from the state and give nothing in return but a super fun cleanup site.
You're talking about doing something about the federal 1872 mining law.
Yeah, but the Pebble Mine, for instance, is on state land. Uh-huh. So you would think the state would be able to set it just like they do with the oil industry. What do we get, 20% out of the oil industry? I mean, we should get something comparable to that with the mining industry. And we could cap it at like $1 million a plus to where the mom-and-pop miners wouldn't be hurt by this.
Mm. Gunnar, what do you think?
I think that
anyway,
this...
Anyway, I'll get off the line. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Terry.
I think there's no question that this option is going to get a lot of discussion and a lot of attention. And the basic option is, well, can we get more revenues out of our other resource industries? And the question is going to be asked about the mining industry, about the fishing industry, about the tourism industry. People are going to be saying, well, look at how much oil pays. Why can't these other industries pay higher taxes? I think that's a very legitimate question these are state-owned resources, and the legislature's mandated under the Constitution to maximize them, the value to Alaskans or benefit to Alaskans from them. So we're going to have a discussion about that, and I think that So on the one side, people such as the caller are going to be arguing, well, some of these industries, surely they could pay more revenue. The people in the industries are likely to argue that they provide a lot of benefits to Alaskans in other ways through jobs they create and through other kinds of benefits. And I think a real practical consideration is that the capacity of these other industries to actually provide taxes is just way lower than for the oil industry. If you look at the sort of actual profits in our other resource industries, and even if you taxed 100% of the value, how much money could you get out of them? It's just not close to what oil currently provides. Now, that doesn't mean that they couldn't necessarily pay more, even significantly more, but the solution to our fiscal woes cannot be fully found just by squeezing these other industries more.
Coming in by email from listener Larry, says, how about if we tax gasoline amount equal to how much its price goes down? So you have the price of crude oil goes down, then after the refining process and everything, the price of the fuel ends up going down. But instead, we tax it back up to where it was before. Of course, we'd have to do something about the Bush transportation costs, he says. But still, that's my idea. That's from Larry.
Some people have raised that. It's one of the many politically unpopular ideas that Gunnar was talking about is to raise gasoline taxes. But that's obviously something that people need to think about. Clearly is that gasoline and other fuel prices have dropped in Alaska, some more than others, based on how much storage they have, capacity they have. I think Anchorage gasoline prices have dropped a lot more than the Bush fuel prices that you suggested. But people need to think clearly
about
this.
Well, yeah, because the Bush already bought their fuel. That's
right.
The
there's a limited storage problem there. But people need to think about that. But once again, you need to get back at what Gunnar was getting at. There's big oil. There's big money in oil, and Alaska has lived for 35 years or more off that big money from oil. And almost everything else in the state, basically everything else in the state, has had a free ride on the oil and the oil money. The oil money is in sharp decline right now. And so people in Alaska need to understand that it's harder to get money, as Gunnar was saying, off other sources. There's just not as much money there to be made.
Yeah. I think that one other point with regard to the listener's comment, sort of getting raising the gas tax or maybe sort of taxing people in proportion to the amount that prices go down is one of a lot of different ways of getting more money out of Alaskans, although, some of the drivers are tourists. But let's talk about the amount of money we're talking about. This year, we're running a deficit of about $3.4 billion, and that works out to $4,500 per Alaskan. So, if you say, well, we're going to get the money out of Alaskans, maybe by gas taxes or by income taxes or sales taxes or whatever, the amount to sort of really address the size of our fiscal problem.
Nobody's ready to dig their debt deep into their pockets.
If you take everything I spend on gas, it doesn't come close. I don't think it doesn't come close to the amount of money we're talking about for my share, my individual share of that $4,500.
$4,500, yeah. That is sobering.
One way of thinking about that is that the average American probably pays less than $2,000 a year in taxes to their state combined income and sales. So Alaskans who have lived for years is basically the lowest tax people in the United States. Would go to double the national average in one fell swoop if you were going to make up the entire deficit through imposing taxes. That'd be a hard thing to imagine, Steve.
Oh, this is neat. No, suggestion from Nick. He says, I don't know if he's serious about this or not. He says, well, can people pick, click, and give to state government? Actually, I believe they can, but I don't think they can do it through that process. But you can actually give your permanent fund dividend to the state general fund.
And I think the state treasury always accepts checks if people mail them in. Exactly. That's my understanding.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm sorry that Scott Goldsmith couldn't join us this morning because I wanted to talk to him about Senate Bill 21. But, Gunnar, I assume that you're keeping up on his work to some degree. And so if we had repealed S-21, would we be worse off or better off now than we are?
The way the two tax laws that we voted on last summer work, the tax rate under SB 21 is actually higher at low oil prices than the ACES tax rate would have been. So we are this year collecting more money under SB 21 than we would have been if we had kept the ACES law. So, in listening to the discussion, I've heard some people say, well, we wouldn't be having this, horrible deficit problem if we hadn't done this crazy change in our oil tax system. And discussion about the tax law this summer was much more complex and involved many other issues. But basically, our immediate enormous deficit in the state is definitely not due to the change in our tax law. It's due to the drop in oil prices.
And we got bigger problems coming, I think, because there are consequences people haven't thought about in terms of the bookable reserves of the industry, in terms of their investment equations. I mean, on up and down the line, the whole issue of how we tax the oil industry is going to need another look anyway, probably. But it's not going to happen this time around, not in this legislative session anyway. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK is the telephone number. And we've got Cliff Groh of Alaska Common Ground, Gunnar Knapp of the University of Alaska Anchorage Institute for Social and Economic Research. Cliff.
Yes, I want to thank Gunnar again for his excellent job moderating the forum that Alaska Common Ground held on the ballot proposition on Senate Bill 21 last summer. And another fundamental point that often comes up in these kind of discussions, including on this program before, is the question of, can Alaska solve its problems just by raising taxes on the oil industry? Another way this is sometimes put is, hey, Cliff, how come we can't be more like Norway and have a giant savings account, public savings account we can just rely on to generate earnings off of, and we can live off that? And that's sort of the answer to both those questions is the same. That would have worked a lot better and would only have been possible if we'd started back in the 70s and early 80s and started having higher taxes, higher royalties on oil production back then, and saved more money and spent less. That's the way that Alaska would have been able to pull that kind of a situation off. And the fundamental problem in Alaska is that there's less than a third of the oil production than there was back in the late 80s. That there's been a 25-year decline in oil production, and it's now less than a third of the more than 2 million barrels a day that used to flow in the late 80s, now less than 600,000 barrels a day.
Yeah. And remember the no decline after 99? Nobody wants to remember that, least of all Tony Knowles and the people at the oil companies at the time. But it didn't work out that way, and it is to the point of engineering fixes at TAPS in terms of making sure that they keep the oil warm enough to keep flowing. They're already having to put extra effort into that and do some heating of the oil at certain points along the pump stations and so forth. And this is going to go on. Okay, so that's the revenue side. We kind of exhausted the revenue side in a way, but there's the spending side. The spending side. And when you look at what the state spends its money on, the first thing that comes up and has come up is capital projects. I think many in the legislature realize they're going to have to pretty well kiss much of the capital budget away this year just because it's pretty obvious the governor's already spoken on this.
Right, but I think that there's a few factors.
But even if you take the whole capital budget away.
Which is only about 10% of the budget, right, as you normally think about the budget, which is usually defined as the unrestricted general fund portion of the budget. So the capital budget is only about 10% of that budget. The budget is widely understood in Alaska to be number one in per capita statement spending among the states. You know, we're number one in a lot of things here, as I say, as a proud Alaskan. One of them would be number one in per capita spending. But it's also important to understand that roughly two-thirds of the budget is composed of three items: K through 12 education, Medicaid, and retirement assistance. So people, when they talk about cutting the budget, they should think clearly about what's actually in the budget, and also think clearly about where they what they want to have those cuts made, and not just. I think it's not the wisest move to say blandly, let's just cut the budget without either understanding what's in it or what those cuts would mean.
All right. Thank you, Cliff Groh, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com. Enroll now in the Health Insurance Marketplace. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Open enrollment ends February 15th. Depending on your income, age, and family size, you may be eligible for discounts that may lower your monthly cost and out-of-pocket expenses. Pick a plan that is right for you and your family. Call 211 for free individual assistance about the Health Insurance Marketplace. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by ASHNA, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
Well, what we're finding out so far is that we can take all the ideas, you know, taxing some kind of royalty on minerals, motor fuel tax, income tax, some kind of sales tax, and a bunch of them I haven't thought of that are coming up, and add them all together, and it's still nowhere near enough to fill $3.4 billion of a budget deficit. And how do we get there? That's what we're talking about, and it's not as if the people we have with us today have the answers. What they do have is information, and that's what we're here. We're just kicking off the discussion, folks, and it's going to go on. It gets to the policy area. I mean, one way that that you deal with state spending is like happened in '86 when all the banks in the state went bankrupt except for two. A whole raft of people walked out on their mortgages. It was an economic collapse. It had some benefits, but, you know, it was a shakeout. When you get the price of oil falling this much, I think we are, no matter what, talking about some kind of shakeout. Don't you think, Gunnar Knapp?
I don't think there's any way we can sort of not have significant consequences in a wide variety of ways, from just the evaporation of billions and billions and billions of dollars that we would have been getting in this state if the oil production, which is the major value in what Alaska produces, had not fallen in half. And so we are going to be experiencing a variety of effects in the state. And the political discussion is going to be, you know, sort of who's going to bear them and how are we going to bear them and what are we going to give up? But I think that there's no way that the economy doesn't get hit by taking money out of the economy. And so now part of the question we face is, well, when do we take the pain? Do we take it sooner by sort of making very significant cuts in the budget right away? Or will we sort of try to spread this out, but then use up more of our reserves and face possibly more pain later and more abrupt and severe? That's sort of part of the issue.
1-800-478-8255. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And we're talking about Alaska's revenue shortfall and what to do about it. We got a bunch more calls. And if you guys are ready, I think we'll just blast into more of them. This one comes from Tom. Says, hey, how about POMV? Remember Frank Murkowski had this idea of dealing with the permanent fund differently and a percent of market value. Does anybody know, has anybody done the numbers, he says, on how much smaller the total permanent fund would be right now if we'd had that? I guess it's silence on that one.
I don't know that we've actually done analysis of that. I have not. Gunnar might have some more on it. I do know that that's a very interesting question, and it has a couple of elements to it. POMV stands for percentage of market value, and there's a technical part of it which the legislature could, you know, the non-controversial part, ironically, could be done easily, and the and then the more controversial part is the one that people need to, you know, I mean, people need to think about it. The controversial part could be done easily. I would reverse that. The controversial part could be done easily, which is spending permanent fund income in the budget. That's one idea that is sometimes associated with POMV. The technical part requires a constitutional amendment, which is actually, you know, changing the way that inflation proofing is done for the permanent fund. People need to think clearly about the use of the permanent fund earnings and what the permanent fund is for. I've often said that that's the most...
As if we knew.
That's one of the most important, questions facing each generation of Alaskans. I've researched this. I was involved in the creation of the permanent fund.
You don't know the purpose of the permanent fund is idolatry. It's this golden egg, this idol that's put on...
Mr. Heimel, I'll let you make this more
when
sort of
rhetorical
statement.
When everyone genuflects and worships and brim, that is no rationality involved in it whatsoever.
I would say as an historical matter, someone has researched this, that the actual answer would be that the permanent fund was created to take money off the table. It was created to save. The purpose of those savings was never made clear
there
or agreed upon in 1976 when that constitutional amendment was adopted.
They didn't even use the words rainy day.
Right. As I would also say, as someone who was heavily involved in the creation of the permanent fund dividend in 1982, which was a different act than the creation of the permanent fund, although frequently confused in Alaska politics and on the Alaska public mind.
Oh, we've got you going now, Cliff Grove.
No, I'm just going to say that people need to think clearly about what the permanent fund is for and what it means for Alaska and each generation of Alaskans needs to make that decision for itself.
Yeah. To respond briefly to the caller's question about percent of market value, essentially what that would have done, it was a proposal to use the permanent fund more in the way that other large endowments are used. One thing, you know, we all enjoy our dividends, but they sure vary a lot. And it's sort of like 1 year you're rich and, you know, 1 year you get a lot less. And the POMV approach basically was a way that would have smoothed out how much dividends people received and also used some of that money to help fund state government. And as a result, it would have had the permanent fund growing less rapidly and in the future earnings be less. And you know, that's an approach we could follow in the future if we chose. And like Cliff says, this is undoubtedly one of the topics that's going to be up for discussion.
Well, yeah, I mean, what's unsaid in all this is, okay, you have this permanent fund and you have a protection for it, but if things got really desperate and there were no other reserves, you know, that's kind of, you'd eat your seed corn if you had to and you were hungry enough. Pretty much as simple as that. Let's go to Don, joins the program in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Don.
Good morning.
Morning.
I was listening to your previous program as well about The Wire, and they were discussing the integrity issue as far as institutions are concerned and the breakdown thereof. I found it very interesting. I've been up here since 1968. I'm very grateful to Jay Hammond and the legislature that prevailed at the time for establishing the permanent fund. One of the key factors I'd like you folks and others around the state to remember is $1,000 dividend put in the hands of a family of four with income under $20,000. That dividend check means a lot more to them than it does to the family making $80,000 a year, because that is almost invariably going to be spent on more needed programs for their own family and their goods and whatnot to take care of that family. That is a greater percentage of their income than it is for the upper class. This business of eliminating it, this business of talking about, well, it's nasty because it just kicks me into another tax bracket, fine, give it away, as the gentleman pointed out earlier. Sit down, write a check, and send it back to the state to help relieve some of that deficit. As far as the deficit is concerned, this country has never, ever been without a deficit. Neither have the states. If you go back and check the Constitution, it doesn't matter whether you go into Article 6 or whatever it is that you go into, you will find this country was born into a deficit state of a situation. And it has never really let up entirely. It has waxed and waned, but the deficit has always been there. You're not going to take it out completely because this myth of cash and carry just does not exist among states and governments. There's always deficits and trading going on. So stay with the reality of it. And, you know, some of these people that like to spin it about how obnoxious the deficit is need to take a second look at where it's really coming from. As far as the taxes are concerned, your sales tax is probably one of the most honest and equitable taxes you can have, for the simple reason people are going to spend more money, they're going to buy more things because they've got the money to spend, then they're going to pay more tax. In the lower income brackets, they're going to pay less tax because they've got less money to spend. And that's just about as simple as it gets.
Well, Don, you know, just I just want to dispute that about the states. I mean, as far as I know, states have to balance their budgets. They would have to issue bonds in order to carry over into debt. I mean, they can't just get money out of nowhere.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's in the Constitution, too. I had a buddy that approached me the other day. He says, he talked to his broker, and the broker says, you know, hey, the market's going down. You want to sell those bonds you got and buy some stock? And he's no. And next day he comes back and says, hey, the market's going back up. You want to sell those bonds? And the guy says, no. I don't care if the yield is low on them. You just don't get better security.
Yeah. Hey, Don, thanks a lot for that.
That's part of the thing about it is you've got a beautiful tax exemption right there, especially if you stick with the municipal and state bonds.
Okay. Thanks, Don. Let's go to Susan, joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Susan. Oh, Susan's gone. Okay. Well, then, I got a whole stack of emails I haven't read yet, but let's go to Wasilla and Cecil. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Cecil.
Hello, how are you?
Just fine.
Hey, something I've really given a lot of thought to over the last few months in this whole debate, and the fact is Alaska needs to diversify. We are a welfare state of the federal government, have been for a long, long time, in a lot of ways. We have an asset in the permanent fund that if we would take the model that's already there with the pick, click, give, and allow Alaskans, and there are a lot of details in how this could be vetted, but allow Alaskans to take that money and invest in Alaskan industry, in Alaskan projects. We have billions of dollars literally there where we as individuals could buy a piece of Alaska and make Alaska employee owned, if you will, citizen owned. And yeah, we are, but this resource is so unique permanent fund. And once politicians, if it gets to the point where politicians start to use that as a revenue source, we know that will never come back. Once that tap is opened, it will be bled until there's nothing left. But I would love to, if you guys know how to get a hold of the governor and be able to sit down and talk about how we might be able to use these assets to put companies up on a similar matrix like the pick, click, give system, to where I as an individual could go investigate those, do some homework, and actually buy some stock, take my dividend fund or a portion of it, and buy into the future of Alaska.
Well, it's certainly intriguing. It seems to me that a person could actually even now set up some sort of mutual fund that was solely Alaska invested. But as to getting qualified for something out of the permanent fund checks, it probably would have to be, probably wouldn't be done through the state revenue department, I would think.
Yeah, it would be a whole new system that would have to be developed. But we have an opportunity there that's completely unique to Alaska.
Yeah, and to your idea is investing then in growing the actual Alaska economy.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks a lot. Thanks, Cecil.
All right.
Yeah. And we have one caller, Tom in Talkeetna, says, wait, it's just a repeated lie that Senate Bill 21 produces more revenue at lower oil prices than ACES. That's what he says. I don't know. It seems to me that it does. It seems that Scott pretty well demonstrated that in his presentations.
You know, the essence of the, I mean, the SB 21 debate was about a lot of stuff, but I think one thing pretty clear is SB 21 has a flat tax rate on petroleum profits, and ACES was a graduated rate or progressive, and it taxed the rate that you taxed at went up as the oil prices were high, so it took in a ton of money at high oil prices, and it took in, and at a certain point there was a crossover where the oil prices fall below a certain level, and the tax rate was less.
Yeah,
and
if Scott were here, he could actually do it on a laptop and show us the, you know, how it, you know, if he put in the different prices, he had a whole model of how it came out.
Yeah,
it was pretty clear that especially down as low, he didn't even have them as low as we have right now, but as low as he went, like 80 something, you know, that already the state was doing better on SB 21.
Yeah, I think one thing that's clear is at the time we had the election and all the debate about those laws, hardly anybody was talking about this particular character. I mean, everybody, the general popular perception was that SB 21 was a tax cut, and you know, ACES was a higher tax rate, and that was certainly the true assumption at the prices we'd been used to for several years, nobody was expecting to be in the situation we're in now with oil prices in the $50 range.
As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
Alaska Pacific University now offers the APU Promise Tuition Grant, a program designed to significantly minimize or eliminate out-of-pocket tuition expenses for Pell-eligible students. More at 1-800-272-7528. This message is sponsored by APU.
Still got time for your call at 1-800-478-8255. Your ideas for Alaska's revenue shortfall. That is the subject. We got experts with us. Cliff Groh of Alaska Common Ground, Gunnar Knapp of the University of Alaska Anchorage Institute of Social and Economic Research. And they're trying to help people understand the proportions and the options behind this policy situation that they're in. They're not making policy calls, and they're not here to do that. One listener, Chris, says, everybody should read Jay Hammond's book, Diapering the Devil. Okay? Cool. Nice to bring up Jay. Jay Hammond's name always comes up when you start talking about fiscal plans.
Cliff, I might just mention about that. One thing that those of us who were around in the Jay Hammond years recall was that Jay Hammond and many other people involved in politics at that time, a big part of what they talked about were the big philosophical issues facing Alaska. And, you know, a lot of discussion, and it was a hot discussion, with very strongly held viewpoints was, you know, what are we trying to do? What are we trying to do with our resource development? What are we trying to do with a permanent fund? Is the dividend a good thing or not? What are we trying to do? And they came up with policies based in significant part on the philosophies that they articulated. And I think that to get through the situation that we're facing, we're going to have something like that kind of discussion again in Alaska to talk about what kind of state we want to be, what size of government we want to have, what our savings are for, and how do we want to structure our economy. I know we have many great thinkers around today, you know, who are capable of expressing those ideas that guys like Jay Hammond and Wally Hickel and so on did in the past, where they're politics were grounded in their philosophies, and that's what we're going to have to get back to.
Well, I think we're getting back around to the issue of the largest single item in the state budget, which is education. Heather joins the program from Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Heather.
Thank you, and thank you for all the work that these people are putting into this. When I first started paying taxes as a young person in Alaska, we had a per... We did have an Alaska state income tax, if I recall correctly, and we also paid a school tax, and if I recall correctly, it was $10 a person. Taxpayer.
Oh, yeah, the old school tax, right.
So could that kind of thing be reinstated? And for people who feel that they shouldn't pay for school tax if they don't have kids in school, I say that it's for society that we want an educated public. Anyway, I'll sign off. Unfortunately, I don't have a radio available right now, but thank you. Or I can listen if you'll let me listen.
Yeah, you just stay on the line there, Heather, and we'll get a little discussion. You remember the school tax?
Actually, the school tax was done away just before I came. But my wife is always reminding me about the school tax and how she remembers that being deducted from her first paycheck and talks about it much the same way as this caller. And I think there's a lot of people that... I think the basic principle is the idea some people feel we should all be paying something and contributing. You know, everybody who's here in the state benefiting from our schools and other things, we all have a, you know, obligation to pay something, and why not something like the school tax? Mm. That, I think, is one of the philosophies that's going to be part of the discussion here. Again, I'll go back to what I said before. Our deficit this year amounts to $4,500 per Alaskan, and so if you think
$10 don't do too much,
or even $100.
So if you think, well, let's say we all chipped in with some kind of tax, and you know, is our obligation. Obviously, that every bit helps, but it doesn't make up for the by itself for the disappearance, evaporation of wealth that's caused by our oil value getting cut in half.
Well, you know, somehow I see, even if people are driven out of the state, school enrollment goes down, the amount that is spent on schools go down. Somehow I still see, you know, education seems to be a huge sticking point. It's hard to see how we could reduce spending on education, that there's any political route to that whatsoever, Cliff Groh. Do you see one?
Well, I think people need to think clearly about the trade-offs and choices, and think about that you'd probably need to pay more like $800 or $1,000 a person. I mean, it would be more of a number for the education budget by itself.
I'm talking about education. The states, forget
school tax. Well, the
state spends a whole lot of money on education.
The state constitution has a provision saying that the legislature shall by law provide for a public school system open to the children of the state. And so the state has a heavy role by the constitution in the education system in Alaska. People need to think clearly about what that means and think clearly about the trade-offs and choices of all the expenditures in the state budget, of which education, K-12 education, is a big part.
Yeah.
You know, I'm privileged to have had three children go through the really wonderful Anchorage school system that we have, and to have both a wife and a daughter who are teachers in the school district. And so I feel that, you know, at least in Anchorage, we've had really good schools, and I really appreciate that. But I'm sure that part of the debate that we're going to be facing in Alaskans is whether we could, you know, educate our kids more cheaply, whether we need to be spending as much as we are. And I think that that's going to undoubtedly be an incredibly passionate debate in Alaska, because between the people who feel that education is essential. That's the one place you can't cut. In fact, we need to spend more on it, versus the other people who say, "Are you kidding me? Don't tell me that, you know, you can't educate kids just as well for a lot less money."
And very briefly, The Anchorage School District, speaking of the Anchorage School District, has shown that much of the cost of education is actually due to the high cost of health care in Alaska in terms of health care for the teachers, other staff, and retirees from the school district. And so one of the big drivers of the high per capita budget in Alaska is the high cost of health care in Alaska, which, of course, is sort of, we could do a whole another program on. And Alaska Common Ground is looking at that question. We'll have a forum on that later this year.
Healthcare, yeah. Yeah, healthcare, and another big one that's back there is the retirement benefits.
Correct. Well,
and whether it's structured right now, and I'm wondering how to get back to that issue.
Remember, the three biggest items in the budget, as I said, about two-thirds of the budget are K-12 education, Medicaid, and retirement assistance. The high cost of healthcare in Alaska drives up the cost of all three of those big items in the state budget.
Wow.
Actually, the high cost of healthcare in Alaska, high and rising cost of healthcare in Alaska, drives up the cost of just about everything.
Yes.
In the state budget and local government budgets, because all these people, public employees, get health benefits of some sort, and as healthcare costs have risen, so have the cost of those employees.
And so theoretically, we've reformed this, and we should eventually see some kind of benefit of a reduction in the cost of it, but not in time to help us out of this problem, I don't think.
Well, the high cost of healthcare in Alaska also, analysts have pointed out, helped make Alaska's economy less competitive, not just in the public sector, as Gunnar and I have been talking about, but in the private sector as well.
Well, it's time for closing remarks, because we only got 30 seconds.
I really hope Alaskans take this opportunity, as Gunnar Knapp said, to think clearly about the choices the state faces and think clearly about what the options actually are for the state at this difficult time and the implications of the choices for addressing the actual problem we have.
I think we need to have, and we will be having over the next several years, but certainly starting this year, a very difficult discussion about how we're going to deal with Alaska having less money from oil. The starting point is to understand that the issue is real.
All right. Next week, food from farms to schools. Thanks for listening. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. If you're not covered by health insurance, you may be eligible for financial help with monthly premiums and out-of-pocket expenses. Open enrollment ends on February 15th. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Last year, 88% of Alaskans who enrolled received financial assistance. Compare plans and see if you qualify for financial assistance. Call 211 to get free local help. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by Ashna, a partner of Get Covered Alaska. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.